This week's podcast is supported by Dalpozo Advogados. Dalpozo represents some of Brazil's biggest infrastructure groups and helps foreign clients navigate the country's complicated legal and regulatory system. Before we start this week's show, I'd like to remind you that the Brazilian Report is funded by subscriptions and support from loyal readers, as well as subscribing to our website and getting exclusive daily content on Brazil and Latin America. You can also treat our staff to 1 to 5 cups of coffee. In return, you get exclusive benefits like special newsletters and behind-the-scenes content, as well as a shout-out here on our podcast. And today, I want to thank our Buy Me a Coffee members, Tom Nolan, Marta Martins, Pan Ludwig, Leslie Seal, Caroline Hubert, Mark Hillary, John Thomas III, Luis Hans, Erwin Menes, Orlando Black, Steve Knapp, Aaron Berger, James Coney, Kars Vresvik, Alasdair Townsend, Peter Abrahamson, Jim Alfadeju, Michael Fryer, Miller Renascido, David Dixon, José Rose Stankovic, Emerging Market Muser, Yarden Ifta, Tonica Thompson, Anderson da Silva, Kat Kramer, Peter Suffering, Anna Lund, and someone who chose to remain anonymous. And the list has been growing, so thank you very much. And if you too believe in the importance of independent journalism, and if you want to hear your name on our podcast, head over to buymeacoffee.com/Brazilian Report. buymeacoffee.com/Brazilian Report. Five months in, and we're now starting to get a pretty good picture of what the Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva government is going to look like. Between the October election and the January inauguration, everything seemed rosy for the incoming administration. Lula seemed to have built something of a progressive rainbow coalition, promising advances for marginalized populations. An indigenous people's ministry was to be created, and the cabinet no longer looked so white and male-dominated. And Lula made big promises on the environment front, even upstaging the existing government by turning up to COP27 as president-elect in November 2022. All the while, there was a certain expectation that, once in office, a conservative Congress would allow Lula to pursue these goals, providing their interests were met with parliamentary grants and concessions in fiscal and tax reform bills. The reality, however, has been quite different. My name is Gustavo Ribeiro, editor-in-chief of the Brazilian Report, and this is Explaining Brazil. At least for international audiences, Lula's environment promises were among the most important facets of his campaign. And less than a half year on, there are fears that much of these pledges were empty words. To discuss that and more, I'm delighted to welcome back Nathalie Unterstel, head of the Tanaloa Institute, a climate policy think tank. Nathalie, great to have you here again. The government had pledged to seek zero deforestation and carbon neutrality for Brazil's energy matrix, all while trying to boost the economy through infrastructure investments. During our live broadcast for Lula's first 100 days, I remember you having commented that these two goals may seem antinomical. How has the government juggled these two very different goals, even considering that we have a very, very small sample size?
First, I think these goals can be combined if we take advantage of the transition to net zero emissions, meaning that instead of investing in, you know, business as usual or government as usual, infrastructure programs or, you know, popular cars programs like the one we are seeing now, it can really boost investments in electric vehicles, vehicles with low emissions, in alternatives, in various sectors that will boost productivity, that will help us to have a better business environment, and that will deliver emissions reductions and climate resilience. I think that's compatible, and that's what we are seeing being pursued by other countries. But as you ask me what's going on 5 or almost 6 months later, or after the inauguration day, my impression is that the government, and particularly the president, he's having to juggle with these priorities in terms of the old and the new mindset. The old mindset is development as usual, so really betting on oil and gas, even in sensitive areas like this area near the mouth of the Amazonas River. And at the same time, Lula has been around, right? He went to many countries, China, the U.S. He's in touch with various international leaders. And so he exposed Brazil and he exposed himself to scrutiny. And now the international community is going to ask him, what's going on? Are you going to, you know, pursue the zero deforestation goal for real? Are you committed to the real net zero transition, or this was just a speech, a discourse? So I think this is the moment. And at the same time that we were seeing a lot of noise, right? I think there are important signals. And I do think that this is a very critical and special moment for this administration to set the tone.
The Lula administration's appetite for new oil reserves reminded me a little bit of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, because he was elected on an environmental agenda, and then he said that no country would find billions of barrels of oil in the ground and, quote, just leave them, in a reference to reserves found in Alberta.
We have to get off fossil fuels eventually. We have to do that. We cannot do that right now. We have to manage the transition. And that's why I have approved pipelines that the previous government wasn't able to do.
Gustavo, this is such a good question. And at the same time, I think there is an important difference here, which is that Trudeau had found oil when he decided to take this specific course of action, right? In the case here, Petrobras has, we don't have any guarantee that there is oil, you know, in that area. There are a hypothesis, but we also have to bear in mind that part of the oil and gas industry runs around trying to find new reserves, and actually they don't, right? It's about creating the expectation that investments will come. So we have to be very clear on that. And then secondly, also important to raise the point that last year and this year, Brazil has ranked third in terms of countries that are approving or expecting to approve new projects. We are just behind Qatar and Saudi Arabia, which are really surprising, right? Even the U.S. with the Willow Project, or Canada, or whatever others. We were silently, you know, moving forward with these big ideas, big promises. And the question is really, when is this going to, if there is actual investment and if oil is found, for instance, in that region, will that compete in the markets of the future? Will it cost in a way that will be competitive with the Arab countries, for instance? We really don't know, and probably won't. Probably the Arabs that dominate the technologies and have much more availability, right? They can be the last man standing in this arena. So what I wanted to actually answer is to say that we in Brazil, like, I don't think we need to abandon from night to day, you know, the various sources of energy we have, but especially politicians, they will be more and more pressured to deliver on net zero commitments, and not only on the forest side, not only on the land use, for all other sectors, right? And by now, they know that phasing out fossil fuels is part of this conversation. It's not a side one. It's not, you know. So anyways, I think this is a very important conversation, which is still to get more mature here in Brazil. It's the first time that we are kind of opening it up and saying, come on, what's going on? And I think that in the case Brazil finds oil somewhere, if there are studies proving that, and then we will have to discuss, will this be our critical bet for the future or not? For the time being, I think Lula and his cabinet will have to discuss this. The Brazilian society will have to discuss this. It's not only a local matter. It's not only for the people of Amapá and Pará just to have a say on this. It's for all of us. And we all know this is about the global climate. So there are considerations also on the nature of, you know, the impacts that we are talking about.
Lula Elis claimed that developed countries are too harsh on emerging economies. Do you think that there is indeed a double standard, that the Lula administration's push for Amazon oil is seen with a much higher scrutiny than those pushes from other Western powers? For instance, the European Union has recently declared that gas is a green fuel, which is not. It is a fossil fuel. So do you agree with that assessment of a double standard?
Gustavo, I think this is an important conversation. And at the same time, we have to bear in mind that Brazil is the fifth largest emitter of greenhouse gases emissions. So we are not Tuvalu. We are not Mozambique, and we have done a lot of investments in the past in clean energy, and that's why more than 80% of our electricity is clean still nowadays, right?
Now, you mentioned that Brazil is a major emitter, not through industrial emissions, but rather through deforestation, right?
Yeah, and then it's quite, I would say, ironic that some people here in Brazil, they are kind of evoking the conversation around developing nations and evoking the fact that there is a double standard. I'm not saying there isn't, but they are trying to use this to say that Brazil should be, you know, should do an energy transition from renewables to gas, for instance. And that makes no sense, okay? And we've been hearing this not only this year, but the past 4 years. And that's why, for instance, the National Congress of Brazil has approved 8 gigawatts of gas and coal thermal power plant through mandatory requirements that are going to possibly kick in by 2027. And that will affect our whole energy structure and also perhaps even, you know, jeopardize our comparative advantages in a future hydrogen market. So anyhow, I think we have to be very careful here about what responsibilities and what responsibilities Brazil has and what is its status before the international community and what are our comparative advantages that we are going to be leaving behind if we go through this fake energy transition. I call it fake because it's not about transitioning into net zero, but actually like kind of changing backwards, right? Doing what the others are trying to get rid of, which is to go back to fossil fuels. So let's bear that in mind, because do we really need that? Is gas the natural solution for Brazil? I don't think so.
Some people were expecting immediate results regarding deforestation figures, but that has not happened. Figures still came high in the first months of 2023. I mean, what happened? Were the expectations too unrealistic? Is it because when the government took office, it found environmental agencies depleted and cut down to the bone?
Yeah, I think, again, like it's important to bear in mind that the context here is one where this new government started, they changed the political signal quite dramatically in comparison with the previous one. But then that's not enough, right? That's a part of the, you know, you start to change the expectations, which is already something super important, both social and economically. But at the same time, you need to deploy people on the ground. You need to start using the tools you have at your hand. And they started doing this. If you go into the information provided by the Ministry of the Environment on penalties relating to environmental crimes and so on, they went from nothing to 200% or 300% increase. So they are operating, but it takes time. And actually, we won't necessarily see the results in the types of alerts that are coming out from this particular system called DETER, right? Because it's a monthly sort of alert, and it's not necessarily giving us the rate of deforestation. This is something we learn once a year, so we have to expect such a number by the end of this year, and then we are going to be able to see it. But right now, what we know is that for the first 3 months of this year, there was more, there were much more alerts than one would like to see. And there is then an important drop in April and May. The figures are looking actually very good in comparison with 2022, 2021. And but again, it's not time to celebrate anything because the dry season is actually starting in the Amazon right now. So it's when deforestation actually happens. It's when people that are willing to deforest will put fire, will, you know, cut the trees, grab lands. So this is the time for real action. And I think you're completely right. Like this government entered, you know, in power with a lot of pledges and, you know, good positive expectations around deforestation, but this is going to take a while. And let's see. I fingers crossed that deforestation will, you know, continue to decline in comparison with last year, at least. But it remains to be seen, and it depends a lot both on federal government action and its alignment with the state, with the subnational governments as well.
And the government also launched a project aiming at making cars more affordable in a bid to stimulate the auto industry. Now, that's not exactly a green agenda, right?
Indeed. Well, they try to, you know, to insert some green, or I would say grayish green, features in that proposal. For instance, they are going to consider energy efficiency as one of the criteria for, you know, subsidizing the different types of vehicles. So there's something in there, meaning that it's not as bad as it could be. It's not as bad as different programs of that subsidized cars in the past. But that doesn't mean it's good, especially in the context we are now, right? Where not necessarily this is the most efficient way to invest our money, or, you know, to incentivize people. And again, I think there is a sort of broader framework missing here. Why are we doing this? Shouldn't we have a strategy before we start, you know, with all of these different programs, which are clearly not aligned, for instance, with the Brazilian climate goals? So again, I think the moment we are now is the moment where there's a lot of moving pieces, but there's a lack of a more structured approach. There's a lack, you know, of a strategy in place. So let's see. Fingers crossed for seeing more cohesion, more unity, and reconstruction, to use the government's motto, from now to the end of this year.
We'll be right back. This week's podcast is supported by Dalpozo Advogados, Dalpozo represents some of Brazil's largest infrastructure groups and helps foreign clients navigate the country's complicated legal and regulatory systems. During the May the 10th Brazil Summit in New York City, an event hosted by the Financial Times and of which the Brazilian Report was a supporting partner, we caught up with Luiz Namura, a Brazilian engineer, serial entrepreneur, and public speaker. Luiz Namura has founded 15 companies and launched or invested in over 300 businesses around Brazil and abroad. So Namura, let's talk this week about Brazil's startup scenario, which is home turf for you, right, as an investor. Brazil is Latin America's largest economy and typically accounts for at least half of the investments flowing into the region. But its startup environment is declining faster than Latin America as a whole. And the recent collapse of Silicon Valley Bank only exacerbated that trend. What are your expectations for the Brazilian ecosystem in terms of fundraising, and how should entrepreneurs face this scenario?
Of course, it's a challenging scenario, but we have been challenging for the last 30 years. In this scenario, we must act like good sailors in a healthy. Take it easy and wait for the sea to calm down.
Being so familiar with crisis, do you think Latin American entrepreneurs are more prepared to weather the storm?
I think it's time to separate boys from men. Like a boy, you do everything you wanna do. Like a man, you do everything you must do. So you must prepare yourself for the challenge that comes from every part of the world. And technology is a challenge. Yeah, it's a challenge. Well, prepared people is a challenge. Yes, it's a challenge. Competitors from all over the world is a challenge. Yes, it's a challenge. So prepare yourself to this kind of challenges.
And which challenges do you think are more pressing for the region's entrepreneurs?
More competitors. 30 years ago, you don't have so many people that could open up a new organization because it demands money, time. And now, with a computer or a cell phone in your garage, you can put up, you can set up a new company. So it's easier for people that have a good idea and technology in her hands, like a palm top, a computer, a cell phone, to set up a new company. So now there are brilliant people all over the world, and the conditions to set up a new company is so easier that these kind of people will compete with you. I think the conditions to set up a company in Brazil and Latin America is more difficult than to set up, for example, in Singapore, United States, and other things, because the environment of Brazil, the laws in Brazil, go against the spirit of the people that want to set up a company. So you must be patient, resilient, to go against this kind of laws that impede the people to set up companies faster than other countries contribute for the people to set up their companies.
That's it for this week. Luiz Namura, thank you very much for your insights. Now let's get back to the show. I'm back with Nathalie Unterstel, head of environment think tank Tanaloa Institute. Nathalie, it will be even harder for Lula to advance his environmental agenda, given how powerful Big Agro is. Now, the Rural Caucus in the House has shown its teeth, and very sharp teeth indeed, passing through a congressional committee last week a piece of legislation that would unilaterally change the outlook of the cabinet, stripping the Environment Ministry from some of its attributions. Now, we are recording this on Tuesday afternoon, so this bill could pass in Congress. What changes would it bring, and why do they matter?
Absolutely, Gustavo. And it's, they are consequential if they pass, because most of them now require to be put to vote in the plenary, or they will go to presidential sanctuary or veto, right? But if they move ahead as they were passed or were considered in the Congress last week, we will see, again, a probable change in the expectations of actors. We have to bear in mind this always theory of rational expectations. Those the actors see that there's the actors that are promoting deforestation or, you know, are against environmental issues. Once they see there's space for changes, in this case through the Congress, they will, you know, probably by default, resume what they were once doing. So this is what we are talking about here. And so we cannot underestimate the Congress power. And there is a very important element here, which is that Lula and Alckmin's government supported that Artur Lira election for Speaker of the House, right? And Artur Lira, in the past years, in the previous government, when he was already the Speaker of the House, he didn't act really in favor of environmental agendas, right? So it's not a surprise that they're now he is now opening the doors for such kind of proposals, like the one that, you know, aims to strip part of the Ministry of the Environment, the other that wants to sort of obliterate the new Ministry for Indigenous Peoples, then the one that attacks the Atlantic Forest Law, and also, and I would say foremost, this requirement of urgency on voting the so-called Marco Temporal, which will be appreciated by the Supreme Court next week. So they are trying to anticipate and influence the vote in the Supreme Court by whatever is going to come out in Congress. So Artur Lira is the key figure here. And again, he had the support of the government. Part of the government, government's base, has voted for these changes, these various ones that I just mentioned. So there's something here about the internal articulation within the cabinet, in terms of being pro or against indigenous peoples, pro or against climate, right? And then really kind of directing the government based in the Congress. This is the first thing that it's kind of problematic at the moment. And the second thing is how to really counter the opposition, which is super-sized. The government has not control of any of the houses, right? And the opposition is very well organized. As you said, the TIF is, it bites, they bite, and also they are very sharp. We know, especially the Bull Caucus, but there are other caucus that are also, you know, present and that will, you know, try to interrupt the so-called reconstruction agenda by Lula government. So far, I think the government has sort of, you know, acted in a kind of ambiguous and unpredictable way. And more, especially through the, you know, international scrutiny and pressure from civil society, I think the government will have to take a stance and be much more, you know, pragmatic and straightforward when it comes to climate and environment issues.
Now, the government capitulated in Congress because part of the Workers' Party was in resignation, saying that it is better to lose the saddle than the horse. And the party on Twitter even celebrated the decree passing in the committee, despite it passing with the changes to the environment ministry. Do you fear that the environmental agenda could be the sort of sacrificial lamb to save the government's economic agenda?
Gustavo, I think this is a real risk. And at the same time, it's consequential, right? Because differently from a decade or two ago when Lula was once in power, the environmental agenda is not a one-person issue. It's not a Marina Silva's issue anymore. Brazil, as we were talking just now, is very much exposed internationally. So this risk, I think it's going to be factored in international partnerships, trade agreements, investments, or capacity to attract investments. So yes, but if the environmental and climate agenda becomes a sacrificial lamb, not only in this case, but in, you know, new cases moving forward, I think then we will be pressured by the international community. And there will be other problems, I think, also in terms of the cohesion and unity within government. So it remains to be seen. And what I meant by saying that the government must be more, you know, proactive and pragmatic is that right now, as you said, there was some resignation with, you know, the proposals that were put forward. I'm not sure those that have led this process, they were sufficiently, you know, aware of the very negative receptivity of this by the electorate as well. So, yeah, it's kind of there are moving pieces here. And I think Lula himself is going to be very important in this. It remains to be seen how he will kind of direct the government in this.
You've just said that the environmental issue is not a one-person issue, but bury me and allow me to personalize it. The continuance of Environment Minister Marina Silva in the government seems uncertain at this point, because let's rewind to 2008, when she left the Lula administration because the government was moving away from her values. And she said that she didn't want to be a, quote, decorative minister. But Congress is trying to make her just that. I mean, if she votes, which is uncertain, of course, but if she does vote, how detrimental would that be to the government's international image?
Yeah, Gustavo, both Marina and Sonia Guajajara have been in many of these international trips that Lula made this year, right? And that were very many. And I think they are kind of the, you know, the symbolic and actual guarantees that Brazil is really or supposedly taking this agenda forward and that commitments are real. If they, both of them, if they are, if they, for instance, decide to leave the government because lack of credibility, because of conflicts in the cabinet and so on, I think this will certainly affect our reputation. So we are just now in the process of trying to restore our credibility, right? There's a lot of investments, including personal investment by the president in all of this. So that scenario, I think it's a very negative one. It's not because we don't have other people that could replace them. I think we do have. But their, you know, soft power is super important, and they are creating a wave, not just surfing it, right? So they're creating this wave together with Lula, and that would, I think, break expectations abroad and also, you know, bring a lot of negative attention that we don't really need. Moreover, that could interrupt the policy process that we were just discussing are so hard, right? The destruction by Bolsonaro was very profound, and they are starting to recover from this, but they are not there yet. So I would say this scenario, it's a very negative one. But then what I hear from different interlocutors in government and people that are around these two figures, and particularly Marina, is that different from 2008 when she decided to leave the government because of the Amazon. Now she's saying that she's not leaving the government because of the Amazon. She's very much concerned with the situation at the various levels over there. And she is resilient enough to stay. For that reason, I'm not expecting her to, you know, resign. And at the same time, I don't think the Congress and especially the different caucus that are not pro-environment, I don't think they're going to stop here. I think it will get tenser and it will get ugly at some point.
And Natalie, before I let you go, is there anything we can be optimistic about in terms of Brazil's environmental agenda?
Gustavo, I'm kind of optimistic about one agenda, which I think Brazil, the Brazilian government, you know, kind of embraced, and I think can be kind of very helpful if approved, which is the carbon price. I think they are doing solid efforts, and that can be a real game changer in terms of signaling, especially to the economic sectors that are, you know, dependent on energy, to signal to them that this issue on this commitment to net zero is real. So I hear the government wants to make progress on this before COP28. And if that's the case, I think, you know, it's a new element and an important one in terms of aligning incentives and starting to kind of change the conversation from, you know, loose promises, speeches to something more concrete. Let's see.
Natalie Unterstau is the head of the Talanoa Institute, a climate policy think tank. If you like Explaining Brazil, please give us a 5-star rating wherever you get your podcasts. It takes only a second and it will help us reach a broader audience. Or better yet, sign up for the Brazilian Report, the journalistic engine behind this podcast. We have a subscription-based business model, and your memberships is what fuel our journalism and keep us going and growing. Thanks to our subscribers, we have been able to cover Brazil and Latin America extensively and been shortlisted or won multiple awards. More recently, our newsletters won the Best Newsletter Prize in the Americas by the World Association of Newspapers and News Publishers for a small or local newsroom. In order to keep doing that work, we really need your support. Go to brazilian.com/subscribe. I'm Gustavo Ribeiro. Thanks for listening. Explaining Brazil will be back next week.